hit in 1970 by a white supremacist motorcycle gang. It would be lovely to see a memorial to Jesus Huerta, who was murdered by police in Durham. It would be lovely to see a memorial to that unnamed black woman who rushed to the university campus for safety and was beaten by Julian Carr.
Maybe there'll be a statue for you, Maya Little. What message do you have for President Trump today?
I think the same message that we've had for Chancellor Folt and others. When they do nothing to protect us, when they do nothing to protect black and brown people in this country, we fight back. We take things into our own hands and we protect ourselves and fight against racism. And that's what we'll continue to do.
What are you majoring in? What is your doctorate in?
I study recent Chinese history.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. University of North Carolina doctoral student Maya Little, arrested earlier this year for dousing the Confederate Silent Sam Memorial with red paint and her own blood. That statue was toppled on Monday night. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Sure. This is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the August Amazee After Dark, featuring Insexuality, Ultrasonic Love Songs, and Death Dances from the Panamanian Rainforest on Wednesday, August 29th at 7:30 p.m. at Amazee in Portland. What does the world sound like to an insect or a bat? You can find out by exploring the insect music you've never heard before in surround sound under the Panamanian stars. Again, that's Amazee After Dark, featuring Insexuality, Ultrasonic Love Songs, and Death Dances from the Panamanian Rainforest on Wednesday, August 29th at 7:30 p.m. at the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry, 1945 Southeast Water Avenue in Portland. This is a 21 and over event. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Here goes nothing.
Tune in to KBOO for Drinking from Puddles, hosted by Brandon, every other Wednesday from 8 to 10 p.m. That's Drinking for Puddles, every other Wednesday from 8 to 10 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Yeah.
It's a little after 5, and coming up next, we have KBOO Evening News. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Oregon Zoo Summer Concerts, presenting Dispatch with NACO and Medicine for the People and Scatter Their Own, Friday, August 24th at the Oregon Zoo Amphitheater. Starting at 7 p.m., doors open at 5 p.m. All ages welcome. Tickets and more information online at zooconcerts.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, 8 of the asylum seekers detained at the federal prison in Sheridan were released this week, with more releases expected soon.
George Tenek, a former Lincoln High School teacher, has had his teaching license revoked for sexual misconduct with one of his students.
And San Diego area Congressman Duncan Hunter and his wife Margaret were indicted for multiple campaign fund violations.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, August 22nd, 2018. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. KBOO News poet Dan Raphael wonders what all is burning.
I'm amazed by the ways of haze. These aren't our fires. Why do we have to breathe, see, and smell them? As if this isn't our planet. As if one of the benefits of power is getting others to suffer your consequences. Last year, the fire was in the gorge, places we visited and hiked, the ash and orange gloom appropriate to our grief, our anger focused on that kid. And a year ago was the eclipse, something we talked about, made plans for, celebrated with others. Unlike the subtler, ongoing corrosive eclipse of our society, our democracy, the moon of the 1% of the 1% digging in to receive all the light and energy of the sun, leaving the rest of us in the cold, dark, and unpredictable. Drought, hurricanes, crumbling bridges, increased suicides, dying oceans. The burning I smell is just a mask, a marinade, because if we could smell all the rotten corruption, how could we contain our rage? What would our frustration and help helplessness due to us. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
Just hold on one more day. Improved air quality and cooler temperatures are only one sleep away. Tuesday's smoky heat matched the record for most 90-plus days in a calendar year. Wednesday's haze and poor air quality could blot out enough of the sun to miss the 90-degree mark. Forecasters with the National Weather Service departments are predicting 88 at the airport. Depending on the depth of the smoke layer, some areas surely will break 90. In either case, today is the last in a series of smoke and heat-filled days for the near future. Oregon Live said the latest HRRR forecast model shows low-level smoke pushing back inland due to increasing westerly onshore winds today. So it looks like one more smoky hot day before the trend toward cooler and clearer conditions begins on Thursday. Thursday will start out partly cloudy and finish noticeably cooler with a high of only 77 degrees.
Eight of the asylum seekers detained at the federal prison in Sheridan were released this week, with more releases expected soon. Earlier this month, federal immigration officials detained at least 79 migrants locked up in Sheridan, determined that they had legitimate asylum claims, a credible fear of violence or reprisals if returned to their home countries. That determination allowed the detainees to ask a federal immigration judge to release them, causing Lisa Hay, a federal public defender in Portland, to file habeas corpus petitions for the detainees. Of the 120 male asylum seekers being held in Sheridan because of Trump's zero-tolerance policy, nearly 80 of them are from India, Nepal, and elsewhere in South Asia. The migrants must still persuade an immigration judge that they deserve asylum, but the court ruling does get them off the expedited deportation list.
The Portland Police Bureau is developing a five-year strategic plan over the course of 2018 and is holding two community focus groups to hear community priorities. According to the Bureau, it has been using the 2012 settlement agreement with the U.S. Department of Justice as a strategic plan, an agreement that lacks the wide support of both Bureau members and community members. That settlement was reached after the Bureau was investigated by the DOJ and found to have a, quote, pattern or practice of using excessive force against people in mental health crises. 6 years later, while PPB has been found generally in compliance with the agreement by an outside oversight agency, community members have often voiced dissatisfaction with the results. Police Chief Danielle Outlaw announced the strategic plan process earlier this year. PPB says the plan is designed to bring the Bureau in line with the so-called Pillars of 21st Century Policing, established by a presidential task force during the Obama administration with the aim of establishing local trust in police. The chief promised, quote, 360-degree accountability during the planning process. The two community focus groups are scheduled for this Sunday, August 26th, and Thursday, September 6th. This Sunday's meeting will begin at 4 p.m. at the East Portland Community Center near the East Precinct Building at 740 Southeast 106th Avenue.
If you feed your cat locally produced Rad Cat Raw Diet, stop now. The products have been recalled because of possible listeria contamination. Radagast Pet Food of Portland said the recall involves all their varieties, with a lot number between 62763 and 63101, and best used by dates between October 19, 2018 and December 3, 2019. Animals who eat the food can suffer serious and potentially fatal infections, with symptoms including vomiting, diarrhea, and fever. Humans who handle the food or touch animals or services exposed to it could also be at risk, with newborns, pregnant women, people over 65, and people with weakened immune systems the most vulnerable. People who have purchased these products should return them for a full refund.
Tashina Aline Jordan, a mom from Bend, has been accused of murdering her 7-year-old disabled son. The disabled child, who suffered through and became disabled through 2 brain bleeds, was found dead in their home on Monday. The child, whose name is Mason, had cerebral palsy and hydrocephalus. Jordan had fatally shot her son. When Mason was 4, many people in the Bend community raised nearly $4,000 to help him afford a bicycle that he could operate on his own and was adopted by his elementary school. His mother, who is part of the board of directors for the Central Oregon Support Network, as well as City Accessibility Board, was hospitalized after attempted suicide through taking a combination of different pills.
With the school year about to start, Portland health and school officials are concerned about measles. In July, 3 people in Portland tested positive for measles. Yesterday, another Portlander was diagnosed with the disease. Measles virus can be spread easily by coughing and sneezing and can linger in the air for hours. Oregon requires children who attend public and private schools, preschools, and child care facilities and Head Start programs to be vaccinated against 11 different diseases, including polio, whooping cough, hepatitis A and B, and measles. Parents can get an exemption for their children because of health conditions or because of the parents' religious or philosophical objections. By the end of the school year in June, 8 schools in Eugene, Springfield had reported cases of whooping cough, with more than 100 students sickened and forced others who are not vaccinated to stay home.
Reynolds School District Principal Enrique Ramirez was found dead behind a stump after his routine jog. Ramirez had gone missing and search and rescue groups set out to find him. He had been out jogging near his residency in the Woodland, Washington area. Although there weren't any injuries, he was found behind a tree stump a mile away from the paved area. The man had gone missing on Tuesday, leaving his wallet and cell phone at home. Ramirez was set to be the incoming principal of the Multnomah Learning Academy in Fairview, a charter school for children entering middle school. Other schools he also served as principal or assistant principal at include Salish Ponds Elementary and H.B. Lee Middle School. The cause of death is still not determined.
George Ten Eyck, a former Lincoln High School teacher, has had his teaching license revoked for sexual misconduct with one of his students. Eyck was under investigation for having a sexual relationship with a 17-year-old student, violating student boundaries on social media, and being flirtatious with students. Eyck left Lincoln High School in July of 2017 and surrendered his license voluntarily. The former teacher has a plentiful background in teaching and working with children and has coached Lincoln High's Constitution team. Many investigators had attempted to get in contact with Eyck, but he refused to answer emails or follow up with those already sent to him. Eyck did not cooperate with officers and will not be receiving any charges.
The Trump administration's belligerence towards Mexico and the recent election of a populist left-wing candidate as president of Mexico have brought a degree of uncertainty to the ongoing efforts to renegotiate NAFTA. An event in Portland tomorrow has been set up by a variety of local organizations to educate the public on recent political changes in Mexico and the history and future of NAFTA. Days of Destruction or Days of Revolt in Mexico will be open to the public tomorrow night at 7:30 p.m. at the Levin Community Center in Northeast Portland. For more, KBOO reporter Sam Bowman spoke today with one of the event's organizers.
My name's Russell Lum, and I'm the director of Oregon Fair Trade.
Can you just give me a little background, Russell, on the Oregon Fair Trade campaign and your role in this event?
Yeah, I'm happy to. Oregon Fair Trade Campaign, we're the coalition built up of labor groups, environmental groups, consumer activist groups, international solidarity groups that come together to voice a better vision for trade policy. And because the Trump administration has been focusing on NAFTA for more than a year, so have we, bringing the fight to the NAFTA realm and identifying the 25-year real legacy of NAFTA's damage. And, you know, we're talking about Mexico because this is the country that has really honestly fared the worst in the NAFTA years. And it's just critically important to nail down an arrangement for Mexico and for the whole NAFTA zone that values justice, that values environmental justice, that values climate justice, to do this stuff right, to make the points that are populist around trade from the left side instead of, say, populists around trade in a manner that Trump is.
Another thing that makes Mexico particularly relevant right now is the recent election there.
Yeah,
the...
you bet. I mean, that's one of the main impetuses also for the event. We are putting on a panel to discuss social movements in Mexico, the changes that have been happening in Mexico, and the outlook that we can see for U.S.-Mexico relations. And we wouldn't be having this conversation had AMLO not won the presidency. That's Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who on July 1st won a landslide election to take the Mexican presidency. The first basically pro-people, basically the first people's candidate to win the presidency since 1940. Yeah, it remains to be seen what kind of president AMLO will be. Progressives won in Mexico this summer, and it will mean some changes. And let's sort them out. Tomorrow, August 23rd, at 7:30 at night, from 7:30 to 9 at the Levin community, we are inviting the Portland community to come together. We are spotlighting certain stories that are happening in Mexico, one of which is basically a water war. In northern Mexico, in Mexicali right now, there is a mega brewery, this mega project by the beverage conglomerate Constellation Brands. Constellation Brands produces Pacifico, Corona, and Modelo, and they flood the U.S. market with what is considered imported beer from Mexico. But it's made just across the southern border in Mexicali in a manner that sucks up farmers' water. We're talking about a desert, and we're talking about a brewery that has egregious governmental and economic privileges to be able to operate in this area that peasant farmers are resisting. Peasant farmers are saying, you're stealing our water, and for the long haul, for the U.S. market to make beer. And so we want to spotlight that water struggle. We also want to spotlight some struggles around outsourcing. In Portland, we have a plant of Nabisco, which is owned by the corporation Mondelez. And Mondelez is now making Nabisco products in Mexico. And we're excited to say that the president of the local bakers union here in Portland actually went on a trip to the Mondelez plant in Salinas, Mexico, and is going to tell us all about it, is going to let us know what it was like to talk to his fellow workers who do the same work as he south of the border, and what the union's position is on that outsourcing and on the really disastrous working conditions and pay conditions that the Mexican workers face down there.
Is there anything that you want to add about this event that you'd like our listeners to know?
You know, the reason that we're talking about Mexico is not just because there was an election that put a leftist into power in Mexico, and it's not just because Trump is trying to re-up NAFTA. It's also because this is our nearest southern neighbor, and this is the little sibling in a long imperialist relationship. And the United States has to come to grips with the economic and other forms of imperialism that it has applied to the Global South and to Mexico.
I've been speaking with Russell Lum with the Oregon Fair Trade Campaign, and we're talking about an event that's happening tomorrow, Thursday, August 23rd at 7:30 p.m. at the Levin Community Center. And what was the address of that again?
That is 5431 Northeast 20th Ave.
That's right.
And we will be in the sanctuary of the Levin community.
All right. And the event is called Days of Destruction or Days of Revolt in Mexico. Thank you very much for talking with me today.
Absolutely. Glad to have been here. Thank you.
Yeah. For Cable Evening News in Portland, I'm Sam Bowman.
And now it's time for today's report from the National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A community meeting was held on the Hoopa Indian Reservation in California Tuesday to update people on the Mill Creek fire. Tribal and health officials are concerned about air quality and safety. As of Tuesday night, the fire was at more than 1,200 acres. Other fires in the Northwest are contributing to the smoke. Crews are containing the Mill Creek blaze. The fire has put some restrictions on air and highway traffic. The Mill Creek fire was caused by arson on tribal lands near Hoopa, California. Authorities are offering a cash reward for information. Prosecutors in North Dakota have dropped all serious charges against Chase Iron Eyes in a case attorneys are calling a victory for water protectors of Standing Rock. Iron Eyes, an attorney and a former congressional candidate, was arrested and charged in February 2017 during actions against the Dakota Access Pipeline. He faced 6 years in prison for criminal trespass and incitement of a riot. Under a plea agreement, the state reduced the charges to disorderly conduct, and Iron Eyes will face no jail or risk penalties to his law license. Iron Eyes and his attorney say the arrest happened on treaty land never ceded by the Sioux tribe. In a statement released by the Lakota People's Law Project, Iron Eyes said it's impossible to trespass on treaty land. Iron Eyes was a high-profile case of Standing Rock. There were more than 800 state cases and a number of federal cases. According to the Water Protector Legal Collective, a group formed to assist people arrested at Standing Rock, as of August 17th, there were more than 100 state cases ongoing. Iron Eyes' agreement was pending final approval on Tuesday. Meanwhile, the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe is preparing for an official homecoming and Lakota naming ceremony for professional basketball player Kyrie Irving. The Celtic star has a family connection to Standing Rock. His late mother was adopted out of the tribe as a child. According to the tribe, Irving has long known about his heritage. He's said to have supported the No Dapple movement, has a tattoo of the tribal logo on his neck, and recently released a Nike N7 shoe honoring water and the tribe. Danielle Finn is the external affairs director of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. She says Irving's agent has expressed the athlete really wants to embrace his native heritage rather than make Thursday's visit a public appearance.
So he's really there to immerse himself in the culture, connect with his roots, and be home. So he very much wants to take time and have his memorable experience in the naming ceremony while also enjoying cultural performances of young students and children performing songs and dancing, and that's kind of what they want to focus on.
Finn says Irving's Lakota name is not public yet.
I'm under the strictest confidentiality. They did find his name just yesterday. So it's actually, again, traditionally in Lakota, they pick a name from the past of the family. Your first name is a name that usually was in the family somewhere. And so I can tell you that his name is coming from somewhere in the past. And it has been a name from his ancestors.
Finn says, similar to other Native nations across the country, having a family connection to your tribe, family, and community is highly important. And she says the tribe hopes after the basketball star's visit, other descendants and those separated from Standing Rock will come home and reconnect. The Reno Gazette Journal reports a Nevada tribe has banned car washes on tribal land during the upcoming nearby Burning Man event due to water concerns. The Pyramid Lake Paiute Tribal Council banned hand car washes along the road by tribal members, which are typically lower than washes in the Reno Sparks and surrounding area. The council says its water system is at near capacity, so the car washes are prohibited until further notice. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report. At 6, it's The Underground, followed at 7 by Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather is increasing clouds and a low of 58. Tomorrow will be mostly sunny with a high of 77. Today in history, on August 22, 1950, Althea Gibson became the first African-American player to compete in a U.S. national tennis tournament after being accepted into the U.S. Lawn Tennis Association's annual championship at Forest Hills, New York. Quote of the day is from another tennis player, Billie Jean King. Be bold. If you're going to make an error, make a doozy, and don't be afraid to hit the ball.
A KKK figure from Maryland was sentenced yesterday to 8 years in prison, four of them suspended, for firing a pistol during last summer's deadly white nationalist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. Richard Preston, age 53, identified himself to media as the Imperial Wizard of the KKK white supremacist group and pleaded guilty in Charlottesville Circuit Court. According to media reports, Preston has argued that he was acting in self-defense. At the same Unite the Right rally, a man drove a car into a group of demonstrators protesting against white nationalists, killing activist Heather Heyer. James Alex Fields faces hate crimes charges and murder in forthcoming trials. The American Civil Liberties Union of Virginia had posted a video on Twitter of a man who media reports identified as Preston walking toward a man and firing at him at close range. Preston was charged with shooting a firearm within 1,000 feet of a school. In addition to the prison sentence, he received 3 years probation, according to court documents.
While Paul Manafort's conviction and Michael Cohen's plea deal have dominated the news, a third Republican political casualty could be just as significant. Yesterday, San Diego area Congressman Duncan Hunter and his wife Margaret were indicted for multiple campaign fund violations. The Hunters allegedly stole more than $250,000 in campaign funds to use for personal expenses and hid their spending by filing false financial records with the Federal Election Commission. Another California Republican Congressman, Chris Collins, was indicted August 8th for insider trading. Hunter and Collins were the first two congressmen to endorse Trump. Having these two previously safe Republican seats cast into doubt because of indictments could help the Democratic Party in its quest to have a majority in Congress next session.
And now it's time for Labor History in Two with Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1980. That was the day that Joyce Miller became the first woman ever elected to the executive board of the AFL-CIO. In her 2012 obituary, the New York Times described Joyce's commitment to women's rights in the labor movement, writing, "Miss Miller saw union membership, collective bargaining, and labor contracts as the road to equality for working women, and she believed that women should be a part of union management to make sure that attention was paid to issues like equal opportunity, equal pay, parental leave, child care, health insurance, and discrimination in the workplace." Joyce grew up in Chicago, where she earned her master's degree in education from the University of Chicago. She first entered the labor movement as a worker at a gumball factory while attending college. After graduation, she became the education director for the Amalgamated Clothing Workers Union in Pittsburgh. She remained dedicated to union education for rank and file members. Joyce was a founding member of the Coalition of Labor Union Women, or CLU. She served as CLU's East Coast vice president, eventually being elected CLU's president in 1977, a position she would hold for 15 years. Under her leadership, CLU worked as a powerful voice for women's reproductive rights, improving child care, and increasing the number of women in union leadership positions. In 1993, President Bill Clinton named Joyce Miller the executive director of the Glass Ceiling Commission. The purpose of the commission was to gather testimony about women's experience in the workplace and to draft a report of their findings. Of her career, Joyce said, "I came to the labor movement with stars in my eyes. I saw it as a vehicle for social change, and I never changed my mind." Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
The Black History 365 podcast, produced by Anthony Cox at KPFT in Houston, keeps Black History Month on the calendar all year round.
Black history is happening every day. It's time to start thinking of it outside of a day or a week or a month. We hope to inspire you by enlightening you with those people and events that should be learned from and forever remembered.
Today is August 22nd. On this day in 1971, singer, songwriter, actress, and record producer Diana Ross reached number one in the United Kingdom for the first time with her single, "I'm Still Waiting." The single wasn't well received in the United States at the time, but she was still a prominent figure in the American music industry.
Achievements and events are not confined to the past. Make sure to etch your own path in the pantheon of human history. This has been Black History Month 365, BAM 365, where you find every day Black history is made.
For nearly a century, the wild animals of the Barnum's Animal Crackers box were caged, but now they are going wild. We're always looking at how do we do things to ensure we're staying relevant for our customers, says Kimberly Fontes, one of the spokespeople for the company Modelas International. The shift was brought on by People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, who are noted for their shortened name, PETA. PETA reached out to Nabisco asking them to change their packaging as circus has been under fire for abusing their animals. PETA also urged different companies as examples for removing circus imagery from their brands. The organization even included in their appeal a design of the animals without cages, but made it as close to the brand as possible. Ben Williamson, a PETA media director, said the new box for the animal crackers reflects that society no longer tolerates the chaining and caging of wild animals.
In Afghanistan this week, rocket fire and explosions rocked Kabul as the Taliban struck at the presidential palace. Two rocket bombs hit as the Afghan president spoke before a crowd to celebrate Eid al-Adha Tuesday. Though no one was hurt, the attack was so near to the center of power in Kabul that it came as a shock, and a massive helicopter gunship response followed immediately. Last week, the Taliban laid waste to the strategic city of Ghazni, only 100 miles from Kabul, prompting a military and strategic response. The Afghan war has been going on for 17 years with no sign of an end. In Iraq, 5 troops and a journalist were killed in a bombing attack near the town of Shirkat as 7 bodies were uncovered in Mosul, likely killed during the recent fighting. In Syria, U.S. Marines continue to pound pro-ISIS forces with artillery north of Damascus. Meanwhile, the U.S. is pressuring the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces, loosely allied with the U.S., to give up control of oil fields and major cities such as Raqqa.
Now it's time for the Middle East Minute Plus. On today's episode, Gray Zone Project reports the identities of key figures behind secretive anti-Palestinian rights digital blacklist, the Canary Mission.
I'm Esti Chandler for the Middle East Minute Plus. Since it first registered its website in February 2015, the Canary Mission has exploited anonymity to smear primarily college students and academics involved in Palestine solidarity activism with impunity, blacklisting, intimidating, and denigrating their public reputations. Today, the Gray Zone Project's Max Blumenthal and Hamza Raza, having obtained documents identifying the owner of the malicious anti-Palestinian organization's web domain, reported the identities of key figures behind the digital blacklist. Howard David Sterling, a wealthy lawyer and fervent supporter of Israel, is listed as the owner of Canary Mission's domain name. The report notes that the Israel on Campus Coalition, or ICC's 2016-2017 annual report, endorsed Canary Mission, praising it as a, quote, strong deterrent against anti-Semitism and BDS activism, end quote. The report also links to a recent story at the Jewish Daily Forward citing executive director of the ICC, Jacob Baim, as having hired a professional consultant to battle a divestment resolution at Ohio State just a month after Canary Mission registered its website, in the first known instance of an Israel lobby group hiring political professionals to battle the nonviolent boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement on campus. Canary Mission's website currently hosts profiles containing inaccurate, misrepresented, and/or out-of-context statements of nearly 2,000 students, over 500 college professors, and other prominent Palestinian rights activists, including contributors to the Middle East Minute Plus. Gray Zone concludes Sterling's ties to the ICC and other pro-Israel organizations having not been previously reported publicly may explain why the Canary Mission website, which thrives off anonymity, is registered under his name. This has been the Middle East Minute Plus, a joint project of KPFK and Jewish Voice for Peace.
And now we have the 17th installment of Tom Flynn's audio series, Retired or Rewired. This is a 20-part series on aging in Portland. What's it like to get old in a city that worships youth? Where Tom asks the question, is Portland a good place to get old?
Here's our series on aging in Portland. Retired or rewired? What it's like getting old in a youth-centered city. Are you up for that challenge? We'll bring you lots of views, but you'll have to answer this question for yourself. Is Portland a good place in which to grow old? Our guest today is Dr. Lisa McGuire.
Welcome to KABU.
Thank you very much.
And the CDC has a roadmap that deals with brain health. Would that be the general name of that?
This document outlines 35 action items for state and local public health officials that focuses on brain health, cognitive impairment, and Alzheimer's disease, and the needs for caregivers.
I read the most recent one that I could find, and it said that Alzheimer's was increasing in the United States. Is that still true now?
Yes, that is still true even in 2018. The greatest risk factor for Alzheimer's disease is increasing age, and the fastest growing segment of the United States is those over the age of 85.
And what's the connection in between cognitive decline and dementia, or when does cognitive decline become dementia?
Well, cognitive decline is a continuum, and it can occur from somebody having very early signs of forgetfulness, which might be forgetting their keys and doing so more frequently, and it might progress into a disease state that is diagnosed by a physician as a specific type of dementia, such as Alzheimer's disease. So anywhere on that continuum we refer to as cognitive decline.
You gather statistics on this. I understand that they are self-reported. People determine whether they feel they're in cognitive decline. Is that right?
Right. CDC collects data on a whole variety of health topics across the United States, and CDC as a public health agency is really charged with monitoring the health of our nation. One of the types of things that we ask people about from the CDC is a thing referred to as subjective cognitive decline, which is really a self-evaluation of their memory. And so in other words, how do they interpret their memory functioning within the past year? And for public health professionals, this is really important because this is an indicator of future burden and needs that may occur in the healthcare system, long-term services and supports, and in communities. We do know in Oregon in 2016 that 1 out of 9 people residing in Oregon indicate that they have had noticeable changes in their memory and confusion in the past year.
I thought that the decline of memory was inevitable with age. Am I wrong in that?
Well, there are what we refer to as normal changes in memory, and then those are that are can be more of a disease state. So this is one reason why at CDC we recommend that if you're having some changes in your memory, especially if those changes are interfering with your ability to engage in social activities, work, or volunteering, that you speak to a healthcare provider about your concerns, and they can let you know if it is just a normal aging process that's going on, or if there's something else going on that could be a type of dementia.
You use the term healthy aging related to the brain. What does that mean?
Well, healthy aging or brain health, what we're referring to is we're wanting people to be able to live life to the fullest for them. So maintaining their health and independence as long as possible. And so at CDC, we recognize that the types of activities that are good for your heart are also good for your head. So, you know, eating a healthy diet, exercising, those things that are very beneficial to your heart will also be beneficial to your brain health.
Is there treatment for Alzheimer's?
Alzheimer's disease is a irreversible and progressive type of dementia. So unfortunately, there is not currently a cure for Alzheimer's disease. But there are medications and other types of interventions that are available once somebody talks to their healthcare provider. So some of these interventions can help with slowing down the memory loss or some of the behavioral or other symptoms that a person may be experiencing.
Is there a medication?
The drugs that are available for Alzheimer's disease and other types of dementias really are to treat symptoms. Right. They are not cures for the actual condition.
And what causes Alzheimer's? I don't understand that.
Well, Alzheimer's disease results from neurological changes that occur in the brain. The actual causes of it is being researched by the National Institute on Aging, also, and they're also researching cures and prevention.
So we don't know what causes it. And you talk about caregivers. This is an important aspect of this. Do you deal with caregivers? Do you have any help? Is there any way that you help them?
So we know that the health of caregivers is extremely important at CDC and across the nation. We know that in Oregon, one out of six people who are a caregiver to a friend or family member are caring for someone who is an older person, and also they have a child in the home that they're caring for as well. And about a third of those caregivers in Oregon are providing 20 or more hours a week caring for a friend or family member. So we do want to reiterate that for caregivers, caring for themselves is extremely important, because caregivers need to also stay healthy so they can take care of, continue their caregiving role and responsibility if they choose to.
Does CDC offer any resources in terms of helping caregivers or helping people understand the disease? I mean, I see a lot of material on your website, and maybe that's the what we get from y'all.
The CDC does have some educational materials available on our website for caregiving. We also work with different healthcare provider organizations to provide training for healthcare providers, so they recognize healthcare providers recognize the value and role and importance of caregivers that they're providing within that family structure, and also encouraging healthcare providers to ask somebody that they know is a caregiver and you know, see, make sure that their health is okay as well too.
What's the prognosis for the treatment of Alzheimer's and brain aging in general? Do you have some thoughts about that?
Once again, I would encourage you to talk to the National Institute on Aging, because they're the ones looking at the cure and treatment aspects.
Right, right. So that
they got hundreds of studies doing this, so they could tell you the latest science.
Does the, and I didn't ask you this before, but does the current budget preserve this effort and this and the importance of it, of treating Alzheimer's, the work you're doing, the work that they're doing? Are those things still in the 2018 budget?
Well, the 2018 budget is not official yet. We're still under a continuing resolution. So I do not know if that is preserved in the 2018 budget. We were preserved in the 2017 budget and the 2016 budget. We were level funded.
Seems with this disease increasing, and with the aging of the population continuing in the way that it's been accelerating, that this should be a high priority. Dr. McGuire, thanks so much for joining us today. Is there anything I should have asked you that you would like to mention?
The only thing that I'd like to mention is that there's 5.5 million adults in the United States that have Alzheimer's disease currently. We know that Alzheimer's disease is one of the most costly diseases in the U.S., $259 billion in 2017. And Alzheimer's disease is the fifth leading cause of death for people 65 years old and older.
Dr. McGuire, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to our series on Aging in Portland, Retired or Rewired. You can listen to any episode in this series or the entire series if you go to kboo.fm and look for the show under my name, Tom Flynn. Thanks for joining us today.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Sam Bowman, Dan Raphael, Summer Barraza, Lucas Campbell, and Tom Flynn. The producer is Kyle Qureshi, and our engineer is David Kesters. The interim directors of the Evening News and Public Affairs are Sam Bowman and Teresa Mitchell. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, and you can also find us on Twitter or on Facebook at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR in Hood River on 91.9 FM. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report. In the meantime, I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. Coming up tomorrow morning on KABU. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Sojourner Truth Radio brings you the latest developments in the court battle surrounding the Keystone XL pipeline. At 9, it's Press Watch, Teresa Mitchell's weekly look at the news you're not supposed to know. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Between the Covers, Courtney Hameister talks about her new book, OK, Fine, Whatever, The Year I Went From Being Afraid of Everything to Only Being Afraid of Most Things. And at 11:30, the film show honors the summer season of Silly with performers who bring comedy to TV and film. All of these KABU programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kabu.fm and click on Donate.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KABU with news from your community radio station.
Good evening. Welcome again to News from the Boo, the weekly news segment featuring news from in and around the KABU community. I am your co-host, Mike Crenshaw, and I have two very special guests here to talk about upcoming installation with us. I have Mizu, who is the founder and director of Water in the Desert. Mizu's interested in performing arts with environmental, ecological, and social justice issues intertwined. And Mizu is an artist as well as one of the people that runs the Headwaters Theater. And I have Annette, founder and directress, curator for Tiny Theater PDX, a hub for different arts communities to come together and meet each other. Tiny Theater PDX is a home for radical performance. So it's good to have you both in KABU. Welcome.
Thank you.
Let's start with you, Annette. So tell us more about Tiny Theater PDX and what it means when you say a home for radical performance.
Yeah, thank you. Radical, in the definition that I am using, is foundational and of the essence. And we are a place where people from diverse communities can get together and rub shoulders and create things together that are new.
Okay, so I've been told, and I often cite this myself in the definition of radical, I identify as a radical educator. So I was told that radical has to do with the root cause. So you kind of covered that when you said foundational. And how long has Tiny Theater PDX been around?
Just about a little over a year. This is our second iteration of the iteration series, but we've also had classes and workshops and one other fundraiser for